loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening and it's happening now. I'm Nicole Roussel, producer of this show. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, a new tranche of U.S. sanctions against Russia will take effect on Monday, including prohibitions on loans, weapons, and dual-use items. The sanctions will remain in place for at least 1 year. Next, special counsel Robert Mueller has given Trump Organization chief financial officer Alan Weisselberg immunity as part of the investigation into Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen. And Weisselberg isn't the only person granted immunity. National Enquirer publisher David Pecker has also received a guarantee of immunity. The news appears to be tightening around the White House, but what is the thrust of the investigation now that it has nothing to do with Russia? Then, it has been nearly a month since a federal court ordered the Trump administration to reunite separated immigrant families, but hundreds of children are still waiting for reunification. In fact, according to the American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU, some 565 children are still being held in detention away from their parents. And then, Houthi rebels reported that Saudi warplanes attacked a village outside of Hodeidah in Yemen yesterday, killing at least 30 people, including 22 children. The dead had fled an earlier Saudi bombing. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll take a look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to Russia and new sanctions. A new tranche of U.S. sanctions against Russia will take effect on Monday, including prohibitions on loans, weapons, and dual-use items. The sanctions will remain in place for at least 1 year and, according to the law, perhaps forever. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. Mark, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thanks for joining.
If there's one thing that I learned in my years in the CIA, it's that the words dual use can mean pretty much anything you want them to mean. Dual use can be anything from fiber optic cable to medicine to concrete. Is that the point here? Is the point to start a slow strangulation of Russia?
I think that has been the point for a long time. This specific round of sanctions is not so much a deliberate part of that strategy as it is an automatic consequence of Trump's recognition, without any evidence, suspects, completion of investigation or anything, of the British government's claims that Russia was involved in the poisoning and non-deaths of a former Russian double agent, Skripal, of targeting him with basically a chemical weapon, a super Soviet secret chemical agent that Britain claimed falsely that no one else had or could develop. When Trump recognized this and kicked some 60 Russian diplomats out of the country, he set into motion a little understood, little known 1991 law, the Chemical and Biological Weapons Control and Warfare Elimination Act of 1991, that when a country is ascertained to be in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, there are certain automatic sanctions and then a pause with some demands and then a second round of sanctions that go into effect. This waited some 60 days. The Trump administration actually dragged its feet a little from that decision by Trump to blame Russia for this poisoning non-deaths in the United Kingdom. And that is what this dual-use provision is. And I can tell you, frankly, Russia, having already been targeted by sanctions from the U.S., from the EU, right now it seems half the world is under U.S. sanctions, including or under threat of sanctions, including U.S. companies, Indian companies, Turkish companies, tariffs on Canada, tariffs on China, tariffs on Mexico, and threatened sanctions against EU companies. The Trump administration is waging economic warfare on the world at this point. Russia's already well prepared for this. They've long since shifted, high technology military items to their own production, substitution of such items, making them themselves. And there's really not much batting of an eye over this particular moment of sanctions that is coming into effect on Monday.
Mark Sloboda is our guest. Mark, John Bolton was in Geneva yesterday meeting with his Russian counterpart. Bolton is the national security advisor. They met for 5 hours. I went over to RT. I was part of a discussion at RT, and they said one of the questions was, is it possible that negotiations like these, normal discussions, could have the effect of mitigating sanctions, slowing down sanctions, reversing the tide of sanctions?
Good question.
And I said, no, absolutely not. I said, if anyone in Washington at this moment was to suggest that, their reputation would not only be tarnished, but at least in a metaphorical sense, they'd be tarred and feathered because there is a complete consensus. Now, Vladimir Putin, who said that these new sanctions are, and again, these are like a sanctions a day.
Yeah.
Like you never know. Like,
and they're serious sanctions every day.
Yeah, three new rounds of sanctions.
There were three new rounds of sanctions this week, one against Russian companies for supposedly conducting ship-to-ship trade with North Korean oil products, one against two companies that did business with a Russian company that is already under sanctions for selling diving equipment to Russia's own government. But this is how ridiculous the sanctions are.
It's bizarre. I mean, and here Putin said, according to The Independent in the UK, Mr. Putin noted, it's not just the position of the U.S. president, but that of the so-called establishment, the ruling class in the broad sense of the word, which matters. And he's totally right about that, even though Trump, as chief executive, certainly has to assume and, take responsibility for what's going on. But this is the ruling class in America has decided on this course. And I just wonder, Mark, why? I mean, why do you think they're doing it?
There's two reasons. Most recently, of course, is this partisan furor over blaming Russia for the American people electing Donald Trump. These, projectionist claims of Russia meddling in U.S. elections rather than the well-known habit of the U.S. meddling in Russian elections. And part of it, particularly in, Syria and Ukraine and elsewhere, is more geopolitical. Russia, along with China and others, is starting to resist U.S. global military hegemony, particularly when their national red line security interests are threatened, as they were with, the attempted U.S. Regime change via proxy war in Syria and, the openly U.S.-backed putsch in Ukraine. And, you show resistance, you've got to be punished. I want to highlight for you, there's an excellent article I really suggest everyone read on this in Bloomberg by Leonid Bershidsky. The article is called "The U.S. Can't Bring Russia to Its Knees with Sanctions," the idea. And then the subtitle is "At Least Not Without Setting Off a Global Energy and Financial Crisis." Now, Bershidsky is a Russian liberal. He's no friend of Vladimir Putin or the Russian government by any stretch of the imagination. But he's usually somewhat more realist and pragmatic in his assessment, which is why he's worth reading. And he recounts an exchange in the Senate Banking Committee hearing this week with Republican Senator John Kennedy talking to the Trump administration's senior sanction officials. And Kennedy demanded to know what they would do if the president ordered them to bring the Russian economy to its knees. They wouldn't give a straight answer, saying instead that the ramifications of such a goal would need to be assessed and that the current sanctions were already aggressive. Irritated, Kennedy insisted, but the economy hasn't been brought to its knees. And this is, you know, the attitude of the U.S. political elite now. Gallup shows the U.S. public, actually, the majority of it thinks it's time for U.S.-Russia relations to improve by, you know, over close to 60%. But the political elite feel, particularly in a partisan split, feels far different. And this just goes to show how far from reality the American political elite is on the question of sanctions, not just with Russia, because sanctions just are not an effective instrument for changing another country's foreign policy. That's been proven again and again. They're just worsen relations and show the need to do something. They satisfy that domestic political need. The Russian economy, despite all of these rounds of U.S. sanctions and EU sanctions, is actually growing. Russian economy is in the positive. It's growing. It has record low unemployment, record low inflation. It's not dramatic growth. It's actually only slightly less than the best performing countries in the European Union. The Russian economy is nowhere close to being on its knees. And Brzezinski's article points out that the only way that the U.S. could bring Russia to its knees with a complete ban on all companies and attacking foreign countries' companies that do business with Russia, which is the world's largest gas producer and a near the top an oil producer as well, is instigating a global financial and energy crisis that would bring the entire global economy to its knees.
Let me ask you, Mark, with that said, we have 1 minute left. You know, there was, up until the Iraq sanctions debacle, no country in the world had been more sanctioned than the USSR, the Soviet Union. I mean, it was completely sanctioned, especially following World War II. And yet the Soviet economy emerged as the second largest economy in the world, using sort of an internal market, a domestic market, self-reliance. Now Russia's more integrated into the world economy, but do you see any sort of rethinking about Russia's economic sort of strategy given these circumstances?
No, absolutely not. In fact, the opposite. Now the dominant discussion is how to strike back at the U.S. with space via this prohibiting any food imports from the United, any type of agricultural imports. The Russian government has already decided that, much in line with Jackson Vanik, these sanctions are not possible to be removed politically, domestically in the U.S. for decades. And they just have to learn to decouple their economy from the U.S. and to some extent from the EU and look to the East. And that's what they've been busy doing. And that's why the Russian economy is not being brought to its knees. In fact, for the average Russian, they're barely noticing at this point. And this is a futile U.S. policy.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller has given Trump Organization Chief Financial Officer Alan Weisselberg immunity as part of the investigation into Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen. And Weisselberg isn't the only person granted immunity. National Enquirer publisher David Pecker has also received a guarantee of immunity. The noose appears to be tightening around the White House, but what is the thrust of this investigation now that it has nothing to do with Russia? We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, this is just getting so sordid. This morning on the Today Show, they interviewed yet another porn star. They called her by three different names. Apparently, one was her real name. The other two were porn stage names. And it was a serious interview about this whole crazy issue. Now we've dragged in the CFO of the Trump Organization and the owner of the National Enquirer. So what are we looking for here? What are we looking at? What should we expect to see in the coming days?
Well, I think what we're supposed to see is they're doing their best to drive this guy out of office by hook or by crook. And it may be working. We have no idea. Trump's a resourceful guy. He's a tough guy. He may be able to fight back. The Republicans will not go along with an impeachment, as far as I can tell. But nonetheless, the goal seems clear. Do whatever you can to drive this guy out of office. And that's what's happening.
I'm unclear. I read all this stuff, right? I mean, we all do. We're political junkies. It's a fascinating story. I'm unclear exactly what it is that this Weisselberg, the CFO of the Trump Organization, would need to say if the investigation is about Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen's already agreed to take a plea. He's likely flipped on Trump already. How much worse could this get for Michael Cohen? And why wouldn't it get bad for Weisselberg? Is it that he hasn't committed a crime? Is it that his information is too valuable?
I put my hand up.
I'd like to hear this.
I'd like to be recognized. What about Donald Trump's taxes?
Oh my God, I didn't even think of that.
Weisselberg is a guy who writes out the checks for Trump to sign. So he is present. He's a party to every transaction that Donald Trump has ever entered into. So, I mean, this is kind of a prosecutorial gold mine, isn't it? But to me, what's scary is that, is that these techniques could be used against anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, the Clintons would be wide open to this kind of thing with the foundation. And a prosecutor who got the CFO of who negotiated a deal with the CFO of the Clinton Foundation and got him to testify about every last move the Clintons ever made, every donation they ever received, every promise they ever made. I mean, my God, they would tie them up for years in court. Isn't that true?
Yeah, and besides tying them up for years, it'll break them financially. I mean, Michael Cohen had a ton of money until he agreed to pay a fine that's probably, we're talking about probably an eight-figure fine.
And all the legal expenses.
I know from personal experience, the guy's probably already spent $2 or $3 million of his own money, in addition to what he's going to have to give up. So
America is moving towards a prosecutorial state in which elections are really secondary. I mean, elections are simply the opening gun for the launch of a prosecution. But I just must emphasize that this will solve nothing politically, nothing at all. I mean, Trumpism will go on whatever form it takes. It'll lead to Penceism if Trump is driven from office. Trump supporters will be driven into deep, bitter opposition. The deadlock in American politics will only deepen. This is like a road to nowhere.
John Kiriakou, Daniel's right. If the government, if the FBI, if special prosecutors, if the U.S. Attorney's Office raids the lawyers of lobbyists or the offices of lobbyists. In the case of Michael Cohen, they raided his hotel, his apartment, his office, his home. They took like thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of documents, including recordings. And Donald Trump, his client, his main client, would have undoubtedly been thinking that these are privileged confidential communications. If the government were to do that to all the bigwigs on Wall Street or all the bigwigs in Washington, the 15,000 lobbyists who constitute the shadow government, they'd all be able to be prosecuted quite easily.
Sure.
I want to read a little bit from one of the Manafort jurors, the one Manafort juror so far who has spoken out. Her name is Paula Duncan. She says and she's talking to the media now, and she, by the way, is a Trump supporter. She said, "It was one person who kept the verdict from being guilty on all 18 counts. They were able to convict Manafort on 8 counts. In other words, if it hadn't been for one person, Manafort would have been found guilty on all 18. He was only found guilty on tax evasion, bank fraud, and having a bank account that wasn't properly disclosed in a foreign country." Now this is the other thing that Duncan says. She said... They didn't pay any attention to the testimony of Rick Gates. That was they considered that corrupted testimony because Gates, whatever Manafort stole, Gates was stealing, and he even stole from Manafort too. And he clearly has an incentive to say whatever the government wants because he's trying to get a smaller jail term for himself. Then here's what she said. Certainly, Mr. Manafort got caught breaking the law, but he wouldn't have gotten caught if they weren't after President Trump, Duncan said of the special counsel's case, which he separately described as, quote, a witch hunt to try to find Russian collusion, close quote, borrowing a phrase that Trump has used in tweets, you know, more than 100 times. Now, here's a juror on the Paul Manafort trial. She says, we looked at the documents. The documentary evidence made it clear to us Paul Manafort was tax evading. He was engaged in criminal conduct. And she says it was a witch hunt or part of a witch hunt because while he's guilty, they only went after Manafort because they were looking for something else.
And let me add something to that. I am reminded, and I've said this before, but I am reminded of a speech given in 1940 by Robert Jackson, who was the Attorney General of the United States and later went on to become a Supreme Court justice. This is what he said, and indulge me, please. He says, if the prosecutor is obliged to choose his cases, it follows that he can choose his defendants. Therein is the most dangerous power of the prosecutor, that he will pick people that he thinks he should get rather than to pick cases that should be prosecuted. With the law books filled with a great assortment of crimes, a prosecutor stands a fair chance of finding at least a technical violation of some act on the part of almost anyone. In such a case, it is not a question of discovering the commission of a crime and then looking for the man who has committed it. It is a question of picking the man and then searching the law books or putting investigators to work to pin some offense on him. And that is exactly what we've seen in this case. And that's not unusual. That's not unique. That's what happens in a very politicized society that we have. But that doesn't make it right. You don't have to like Donald Trump. You don't have to like or support Paul Manafort or Michael Cohen or any of these other people to realize that this has nothing to do with Russia. It has nothing to do.
Which is why the probe started.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean,
and that juror is correct.
And let's for our audience, we're a Sputnik News show. This is Loud and Clear. We've been very vociferously opposed to Donald Trump during the election campaign, after the election campaign. We weren't supporters of Hillary Clinton either. We were independent, but very strongly opposed to Donald Trump. And we've always said, if there's evidence of Russian collusion, we want to talk about that. But the other thing we've said is that absent hard evidence about Russian collusion, we believe that setting up a prosecutorial state, which is what Daniel Lazar is telling us exists in America, so that politics are played out vis-a-vis the prosecution of targeted individuals. And John, you just made it so clear from the document you read, anybody can be targeted. And so, Daniel, when you think about the aggregation of prosecutorial power, FBI power, special counsel power, U.S. attorney power, I don't see why liberals or progressive people who justifiably disagree with Donald Trump on many things should be that happy, because that aggregated power will eventually be turned against anyone the government decides to target.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a political prosecution first and foremost. And in fact, Judge Ellis, the guy who presided over the Manafort trial, said that. He said, like, I believe it was last April, was it? He told the Mueller's lawyers that the only reason that Manafort was being prosecuted was to get him to testify against Trump. He said it was obvious he was being held hostage. Now, and by the way, the New York Times in a recent article declared that anyone who believes this is a political prosecution is engaging in conspiratorial thinking. Now, that is just bonkers. It's obviously a political prosecution, and these powers are very dangerous because they can be used against anyone who the powers that be at the moment don't like. That worries me a great deal.
And let's talk again about the immunity. Now, you have Michael Cohen has said he was guilty of several crimes, including campaign contribution crimes, and he was ordered to do so by the then candidate, which of course is Donald Trump. So when we look, there's two or three elements of this. Michael Cohen pled guilty to a particular offense. He gave Stormy Daniels and another woman money, hush money, so they would not talk. That contributed to the campaign of Donald Trump. He didn't report it. Thus, it's a campaign contribution violation. He says that Donald Trump ordered him to do that. That means Donald Trump also was a co-conspirator in the crime. There is, John, as you know, the issue of conspiracy.
Indeed.
And now we have, I was reading the op-ed today, I think it's in the New York Times, of an Obama solicitor general or one of the lawyers for the Obama administration saying conspiracy is a much more important charge. Like, and he makes the argument, well, look, if you go, you're in a state where marijuana is not legal, and you buy or sell a joint, you know, one marijuana cigarette, you've committed a crime. If your friend also has sold a joint, a single marijuana cigarette, that person has also committed a crime. And you might face a small penalty for it. But if you together decide you're going to sell a marijuana joint, even though if the outcome will be the same, the sale of one marijuana cigarette, you're now liable because of a conspiracy between two people to commit a crime. And it doesn't even mean you had to sell the cigarette. You just planned to sell this illegal marijuana cigarette. Then you're going to get a mandatory minimum of 5 years in many states. And this Obama solicitor is saying, that's really important because that protects society, because conspiracy is really, really dangerous to society. But it seems to me to be conspiracy charges just mean the government and the prosecution can convict anyone almost of anything, even when there's been no crime committed, and give them an even heavier sentence. That puts pressure on all people. So we have Trump's CFO, the chief financial officer, who undoubtedly knows about Donald Trump's taxes. We have Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's lawyer. And now David Pecker,
of all people,
who is, the media mogul who was doing the catch and kill, buying the stories of people like the Playboy model who said she had an affair with Trump and she was trying to sell her story. He bought the rights to the story and then did not publish the story. They all have immunity. That means, it would seem to me that this means significant big trouble for Trump coming down the road. I feel like we've hit a fork in the road, in fact, in terms of where this is going.
We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It has been nearly a month since a federal court ordered the Trump administration to reunite separated immigrant families, but hundreds of children are still waiting for reunification. In fact, according to the American Civil Liberties Union, some 565 children are still being held in detention away from their parents. We're joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition. Juan Carlos, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Juan Carlos, some of these numbers are chilling. 23 of these children are under the age of five. 343 parents have already been deported from the United States. 139 parents have already waived reunification because they were forced or coerced to give up their rights. This is really no longer in the news. This should be a top story in the news.
Yeah, that's right. It's not in the news.
It's not. Why is this not being
organized
covered?
Child abuse by
that's right.
The U.S.
Kidnapping.
Government.
Go ahead.
It is nothing but a criminal act. Right from the start, I think the government, this administration, did not have the intention to reunify our families. And this is an evidence of that. This is psychological torture. This is practically breaking international law. And it's a clear message to our communities, a message of terrorizing our communities, or basically saying that they have the power to disappear our loved ones, not to reunite the children with their parents. It's an act of cruelty. I had never seen
this much of this level of cruelty visited upon our communities. You know, I've been fighting within the immigrant rights movement for over 20 years, and I never seen this evil around us. We have a whole system already that is established and well-oiled that separates our children from their families, from their parents. But this level of cruelty hasn't been done, hasn't been accomplished until now.
You know, it's really something, John, when you think about if the government wants to make something happen, if it's really a priority, let's say sending cruise missiles to Syria after news reports about
right.
a chemical attack, or dispatching troops anywhere to Libya or to, you know, to Afghanistan. If there's a like a crisis, an emergency, and the government says this is a top priority, things happen. And the fact that we now have hundreds of children who are, I mean, including children under the age of five, who have been forcibly separated from their parents for weeks, months, and the U.S. government says haplessly, oh, we just can't, we're trying, but we just can't do
and
it.
And imagine the psychological damage that has been done to these kids. As you just said a second ago, some of them under the age of five. There are going to be children involved in this right now who will never get over it mentally and psychologically. They're going to be broken because of this experience, and it was entirely avoidable.
Avoidable and entirely deliberate.
That's right.
I mean, they made it clear. Sessions, Jeff Sessions and Trump, whatever their own falling out with each other is mm-hmm. over this, that, or the other thing, they were united on this. Let's separate kids from their parents and traumatize both, and that will be a deterrent to other families trying to seek political asylum in America, especially if they're not white families coming from Europe. Go ahead, Juan Carlos.
Yes, you know, like I've been part of some reunification with families. So we have kids who are 6 years old basically saying, you know, that woman pointing to their mothers after being separated for 2 months, 2 months and a half, we still have parents that, you know, are in detention centers and we know where their kids are. And they are not being allowed to be united. But these kids are angry. These kids do not understand what's going on. And you write on when you say that the damage has already been done. You know, we have to talk about reparations. We have to talk about acknowledging the intention of this government, the virtual wall that is already well established, backed up by a system, by a whole apparatus of Homeland Security that has the intention of, you know, continuing to terrorize our communities. There is nothing humane about this. It's really a war of hatred, a war of racism, a war that terrorizes our communities and that is well established and in place.
Yeah, I'm looking at the New York Times. More than 2,000 children were separated from their parents. This just came out from their parents at the border. After a judge ordered the U.S. government to promptly reunite the families, the government claimed it would be nearly impossible to do so. The government has said that it met court-ordered deadlines to reunify migrant children with their parents, but it deemed hundreds of families, quote, ineligible for the process. Of the children who remain in federal custody, more than 300 have parents who were deported without them. Why? This was not necessary. This was somebody's decision. I mean, there's policy, but these are actually human beings with authority making those kind of decisions. I mean, what about accountability for them as human beings, as individuals?
Yes. And you know, Border Patrol has the full power and discretion not to do that, but to, you know, basically allow families to remain together. So this is the work of not just one person. It is a whole system that is set up to do this. You know, it is easier for the system right now to separate kids, to separate families,
and continues to terrorize our communities. So we need to denounce that. We need to ask for reparation to these families. We need to ask the government to stop this, because as we know, last week we still had families at the border being separated. We need to full accountability, full transparency, and we need those people who have made these declarations, irresponsible declarations, to really pay up the consequences. This is a crime, nothing less than a crime. This is cruelty against our humanity, our common humanity, not just against the people. You know, what kind of a country does this? You know, who are we before the international community? I think we need to account for that. We need to pay up. We need to do reparations. Our families who are being reunited, they are being practically abandoned. They are being practically left to their own means after such a traumatized experience. So we need to denounce that also. Here in New York, you know, like the Cayuga Center, we don't know how many kids we still have in our facilities here. There is no monitoring. Remember, these are mostly agencies that work without any check and balances.
Juan Carlos, let me jump in. What is, you're in New York City. Your organization is New Sanctuary Coalition. When you finish here, I want you to tell people how to find your organization, what your website is. But what is the Cayuga Center?
The Cayuga Center is one of, I think, around the New York area, there are like seven centers that do foster care for children. And they basically it's a private company that they've been in business, in the foster care business, for many years, since the 70s. So that they get the children and they place them. Practically, they are asking for families to come and foster a child. So they have a psychological service for them. They have a care services, children care. But basically, they vet families who can take the kids home and they pay them. And they basically pay them $1,000 per month. Given that the high demand, like we do know for a fact that some families got 12 kids, you know, 8 kids per family. Some of the families were not vetted.
Yeah, so they're making, so the families can actually receive a lot of money. We have 10 seconds left. Just say your website real quick, Juan Carlos Ruiz.
www.newsanctuarynyc.org.
All right. Thank you very much. John, that's all the time we have.
It is. We were joined by New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Houthi rebels reported that Saudi warplanes attacked a village outside of Hodeida in Yemen yesterday, killing at least 30 people, including 22 children. The dead had fled an earlier Saudi bombing that had killed 44 civilians. We're joined from Chicago by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy, welcome back.
Thank you.
Kathy, we're seeing information coming from outlets like CNN and some of the other major U.S. and foreign press outlets, but they're really only quoting the Houthi rebels. Can you tell us what you're learning about what's happening in Yemen right now?
Well, certainly children are being attacked and children are dying from airstrikes. They're also dying because these airstrikes are so debilitating the country that the rates of people now succumbing to starvation and an anticipated cholera epidemic is likely to afflict even more. Children are being brutalized, killed. They've committed no crime. And still, the Saudis have spoken about the attack on the school bus on August 9th being a legitimate military operation. Human Rights Watch came out today with a report that basically says the Saudis have whitewashed their past actions in the independent investigation that they led on themselves. And the United States public is largely unaware that the United States is at war against Yemen, that the Saudis are using bombs manufactured and in the United States, sold to them by companies profiting from this war, and that the United States is fueling the warplanes that the Saudis and Emiratis and others in the coalition use to launch these attacks. And the United States is involved in the surveillance. I mean, what kind of surveillance would target school buses filled with children?
Kathy, I want to ask you to tell our listeners, we have many in the Chicago area and in the near Chicago Midwest area, in addition to other parts of the country. You have a really important activity coming up. Talk about that and how people can get involved with it.
We want people in Chicago to consider joining us on August 30th and 31st. That's a Thursday and Friday of the week following this week. And we'll be in the Federal Building Plaza at 230 South Dearborn, setting up 44 children's book bags, because UNICEF issued 44 book bags to children, Yemeni children, on an outing, a holiday outing, a field trip. And the kids were excited. There are pictures of the children on the bus doing what kids do, you know, on a bus and squirming and excited and jostling. And the next thing you know, there's a picture of the wreckage of that same bus, because it was hit by a 500-pound Mark 82 laser-guided missile manufactured by Lockheed Martin, sold to the Saudis, and the fragments of that bomb are amidst the wreckage. And then CNN shows the horrific pictures of tortured children. They're bloodied, burnt, screaming, crying. They're among the survivors. 44 children were killed. 11 adults were killed that day. And so in setting up the book bags, we want to reach out to the Chicago public and also to say that the Senators Durbin and Duckworth in our situation in Chicago must speak out and publicly oppose the United States participation in and support for war in Yemen. And we encourage people in other parts of the country to be in touch with us. You know, there is a price to order 44 book bags from an outlet store, but we think it's a worthwhile activity. Or, you know, set up the photos and hold placards, distribute flyers, but we must begin to educate the United States public, because the mainstream media simply will not either raise the issue or stay with the issue. And we've seen before how children die in the hundreds of thousands, and their deaths are eclipsed, unrecognized, and yet the survivors will assuredly never, ever, ever forget the loss of their children to airstrikes, to starvation, and to cholera. We have to begin to raise a hue and a cry about Yemen and say we do care and we won't go away.
And we're talking about the website vcnv.org. That's voicesforcreativenonviolence.org. You can check out the website, which actually is very well done. I'm on it right now. It's really terrific. It's full of news, and it makes it very easy to get involved. Check it out, vcnv.org. Tell us also, Kathy, elsewhere around the United States, is there anything happening realistically, meaningfully, to protest this war in Yemen? I have to agree with you that this is not just a Saudi-Emirati war on Yemen. This is an American war on Yemen. You can call it a proxy war. You can call it whatever you want. But when it's a Lockheed Martin 500-pound laser-guided bomb that's being used to kill these children, or drones manufactured by Northrop Grumman, or missiles manufactured by, you know, with Boeing engines, that's an American war.
Yeah, and before you answer, Kathy, I just want to jump in and say you're 100% right, John. And, you know, just think about it, everybody. If, let's say, Venezuela dropped a 500-pound laser bomb that killed 44 kids on a school bus, or let's say Russia did, or North Korea. I mean, that's all that would be in the news. But when it's Saudi Arabia, this principal ally of the United States, in spite of its abysmal, disgusting human rights record, almost nothing. And that, Kathy, speaks to, like, the feigned humanity of the American media. If you actually have humanity, you can't turn away from this story. Go ahead.
Well, I think that we do find some of the humanitarian agencies that have had a long history of working in Yemen doing their best to raise the issues. For instance, this evening in New York, the head of Oxfam, in one of the people most knowledgeable about the war in Yemen, will be speaking at the New York Catholic Worker House. St. Joseph's House is on First Avenue. There are people who every Saturday demonstrate in Tompkins Square in New York City and hold up placards and have done their best to try to engage in outreach. We're hoping that people will gather in New York in November when the Saudis are up for reassessment of their human rights record at the United Nations, and there are groups that are planning to collaborate for something in New York then. I'm aware of people in some other parts of the country who are certainly trying to mobilize more attentiveness and more public opposition and more calls being issued to elected representatives, but it's nowhere near enough. But that doesn't mean that we can excuse ourselves and say, well, it's just, you know, too much of an uphill struggle. But I do believe that the mainstream media has been sporadic and kind of lethargic in reporting on these terrible human rights abuses.
Kathy Kelly is our guest. She's with the Voices for Creative Nonviolence in Chicago. They're planning an event, two events in Chicago area, August 30th and 31st from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. in the plaza around the Federal Building. I know you're going to start doing press work. I was noticing, Kathy, you quoted a journalist, and I think you're going to be releasing this, and it's so important. The journalist is Samuel Oakford. He recently, you say, offered this comparison about, this is about America's role. If an airstrike was a drive-by and killed someone, the U.S. provided the car, the wheels, the servicing and repair, the gun, the bullets, help with maintenance of those, and the gas. I mean, well done, because it's exactly sums up in a sort of a lay person's way of understanding what the U.S. role actually is. We have a minute left, Kathy.
Well, and also within the United Nations Security Council, the United States is more or less providing cover for Saudi Arabia, so that there has not yet been one single resolution that names the Saudis as one of the warring parties, even though the head of UNICEF, the country director for humanitarian concerns in Yemen, has certainly been saying this has got to stop. Lise Grand has labeled this as a crime against humanity.
All right. And we want to encourage people as we're going out, John, to go to that website.
It's vcnv.org. Well, we would like to thank Kathy Kelly, who joined us from Chicago. Kathy is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's Friday, so we will look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Patt. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, LeftEyeBlog. And we are joined in studio by Sputnik News producer Nicole Russell. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks.
John, did you say the most, what did you say, most misleading headlines?
Yeah, but I don't want to start with the most misleading.
Because we have disgusting and funny headlines.
Disgusting
too.
And funny are more fun. But since it's Friday,
I don't know if disgusting is more fun.
Well, let's go with funny then.
Okay, let's start with funny. Steve Patt, what's funny?
Well, here's the funny headline of the week with Michael Cohen all over the news. I love this headline. Michael Cohen's lawyer says his client would never accept pardon from corrupt Trump. Now,
the corrupt is in quotes.
the corrupt is in quotes. Now, first of all, as if Michael Cohen is ever in any world going to get a pardon from Donald Trump, that is not going to happen. So it's kind of a ridiculous thing for him to say.
You mean just because he said when he pled guilty that Donald Trump directed him to commit a crime, you think that's a non-starter for the pardon? That's what you're getting at?
That's my feeling, yes.
Well, what about the other part? Maybe Michael Cohen is too pristine that he would never accept a pardon that would mean that he wouldn't go to prison because Donald Trump is corrupt, but he just pled guilty to 8 different crimes.
Exactly. And, you know, the idea that he would spend 4 years in jail just to stand on this, whatever you call this principle, that's also...
I mean, when you think of Michael Cohen, you think principal.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't think of all of those 200 medallions, each worth $1 million for the taxi business or paying people hush money. You think there's a man of principle.
It's nice he found principles at this point in his life, you know?
Yeah, you mean like principal and interest.
Oh, yes, loan. Exactly.
Anyway, let's go to another funny headline.
Well, okay, this one is... I'll just read the headline. The U.S. Marine Corps, USMC, would like you to know that being in armed combat is exactly like playing Super Smash Brothers. Now, I'll preface all this by saying I don't know anything about video games, so I really don't know what Super Smash Brothers is, but I can take a wild guess and have some idea anyway. But the U.S. Marine Corps, their social media team, apparently they're desperate to get people on board. So they put it together. There's a new video game release, Super Smash Brothers. So they put together a video with the characters, and their tweet about this video says, "Meet the characters in the smash hit military that has been defeating our foes since 1775.
I can see Marine recruiters coming to the door of a home of a kid who's 17 years old, and they talk to the parents and say, yeah, this is what you get. You enlist for 4 years and you get these benefits and these benefits. And then the Marine recruiter says to the potential enlistee, look, I want to talk to you by yourself for a second, outside of earshot from your parents. Guess what? If you join the Marines, it'll be just like playing Super Smash Brothers. Because, of course, parents would think, no, this is not a video game. You're going to be sent to faraway places to be shot at by people you don't know and to shoot back. You're likely to be hurt or killed. Anyway, the parents just wouldn't go for this. But I could see teenagers maybe being gullible enough to go for it if they're playing a lot of video games.
I mean, I don't think anyone's going to go for it. It's a video game from the 90s. They really got to update these references.
Oh,
you know?
These are for like the potential 40-year-old Marine recruits. Oh, my goodness. You're right.
And of course, in case you didn't pick up on that, the part about defeating our foes since 1775 is a little bit of a misconception on the part of the Marine Corps. They seem to have forgotten about Vietnam, Afghanistan, all sorts of other places where the U.S. Marine Corps hasn't been doing so well. I'm afraid they got the on the video game in those.
All right. Let's go to
another.
Can
you make that sound again?
Yeah, I'm not sure what that sound was. Was that a human voice?
Isn't that what happens when you get killed in a video game?
Oh, I see. I didn't get it.
I think you did great. It's a good sound from the 80s or 90s.
Okay,
for sure.
What about the one that says, Trump says longstanding legal practice of flipping, quote, almost ought to be illegal?
I mean, what can you say about that other than that it's hysterical?
It exists. Okay, let's go on. We have, because time goes fast, let's go on to some of the misleading headlines.
Well, my favorite misleading headline, again, the headline is actually perfectly accurate. It says, Rudy Giuliani stuns NBC's Chuck Todd, truth isn't truth. And of course, everyone has been all over this story. Ha ha, Rudy Giuliani, what a clown, what a jerk. He made this ridiculous statement that truth isn't truth. And of course, Giuliani framed it as a what's called a he said, she said situation where, you know, Michael Cohen says Trump did something and Trump says he didn't and who knows what the truth is. But the fact of the matter is that truth isn't truth is an absolutely true statement, if I want to make a silly way to say it. And a very good example is the statement, the Russians poisoned the Skripals. If you read the media, the U.S. media, that is unchallenged truth by the media. It's completely accepted. There's no question about it. But there isn't not only is there a complete lack of proof of that statement, there's only the most tenuous of circumstantial evidence that would suggest that that's the case. But yet, 95% of Americans probably consider that statement true. So Giuliani is absolutely correct, although in his own, you know, stupid, silly way.
It must be hard for you to say that Rudy Giuliani is correct about anything, but but you're right on this. I mean, he was trying to make a different point, and of course, it's kind of gotcha media. And Giuliani, I mean, Giuliani yells and screams. I mean, by the way, he's an extreme racist. I lived in New York for a long time. But he speaks poorly, but nonetheless, he speaks in a kind of like Donald Trump in a way. So maybe that's why Trump wants him. We have 2.5 minutes. I want to go. We've talked about misleading headlines. We've talked about funny headlines. Let's spend a moment talking about really disgusting headlines.
Well, the worst situation, the worst headline that's been in the media in several weeks. This was actually 2 weeks ago, but we've been off the air for our segment for a while. So I wanted to do this one. This was a 2 weeks ago. Israel killed two Hamas members kind of totally unprovoked. And as a result, Hamas did some missile strikes against Israel. And as a response to that, Israel launched, as they usually do, major airstrikes against Gaza. And the result of that was several people were killed. And the BBC first ran a headline very quickly. It said, Israeli airstrikes kill woman and baby. And they changed that very quickly because actually the kid who was killed was 18 months old. So they changed it to Israeli airstrikes kill woman and toddler. And immediately the Israeli foreign ministry complained about this and claimed it was a lie and a misrepresentation of reality and that Israelis were targeted by Hamas and the IDF was acting to protect them. That's a quote from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Israel. And they demanded in all caps that the BBC changed their headline, and 10 minutes later, sure enough, BBC changed their headline to read Gaza airstrikes, no longer Israeli airstrikes, to know so you know who did it. Now it's Gaza airstrikes, which makes it, you know, maybe it was Hamas who did these airstrikes, who knows. Gaza airstrikes kill woman and child after rockets hit Israel, as if, you know, that justifies the killing of a woman. And by the way, she was pregnant, so it wasn't just a woman and a toddler. But it was a woman and her unborn child and this toddler as well. So it's really outrageous that within 10 minutes, the BBC changed their headline. And one of the really subtle things about this is that the phrase kill woman and toddler is in quotes, which implies that BBC isn't saying they know this to be true. They were just told this. But then they change it to kill woman and child, which doesn't sound as bad as a toddler. But it's still in quotes.
Yeah.
So
Steve,
can't change the quote.
No, we're going to run out of time. And actually, we have run out of time. But I want to just mention, John, as we go out, there is this other headline in the disgusting headlines part, which isn't, again, the headline's not disgusting. The story is disgusting. NASA backs designs for 3D printed homes on Mars. again, Steve was going to talk about, well, we can't solve the homeless problem, which right. Of course we can. But guess what? NASA is spending money to help prepare for 3D homes on Mars.
At least we have that. Well, joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Patt. Steve is with us every week. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, LeftEyeBlog. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News producer Nicole Russell. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio and now at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.